This podcast is brought to you by the Gosh Learning Academy.
Welcome to the fourth series of Gosh Pods Goes Green. In this series, we're going to be focusing on plastics in healthcare. Notably, single-use plastics represent approximately 23% of the NHS's total waste. These materials are seldom recycled and are predominantly incinerated at high temperatures, contributing significantly to the NHS's overall carbon footprint. And in 2021, Great Ormond Street Hospital was the first UK children's hospital to declare a climate and health emergency. Over the next 6 weeks, we are going to be exploring this topic further, moving on from well-known facts about plastics being made from fossil fuels and taking hundreds of years to decompose, to talking about the health implications of plastics and what healthcare professionals can do at a product and systems level to reduce plastics. How do we balance the risk with infection control? And finally, what happens to plastics in waste? Hello and welcome to this, our fourth series of Gosh Pods Goes Green. In this series, we'll be exploring plastics in healthcare. I'm Nicola Wilson, the Head of Sustainable Education and the Project Lead for the Born Green Generation Initiative here at Great Ormond Street. Today, I am joined by Helen Dunn, Consultant Nurse for Infection Prevention and Control and Director of Infection Prevention Control, and Rose Gallagher, the Professional Lead for Sustainability at the Royal College of Nursing. And we're all going to talk about single-use plastics and balancing that risk with infection control practices. Helen, can I start with you? Can you tell me a little bit about yourself and your role within the hospital?
Yeah, thanks, Nicola. My name's Helen Dunn, as Nicola's already given my rather long title, but essentially I run the infection control team at Great Ormond Street. I've been here for about 11 years, but I've worked in a variety of different healthcare settings, both in the UK and overseas. And I've been in infection control for 22 years.
Rose, can you tell us a little bit about your role and how did you get to be in sustainability for the RCN?
My nursing career, so as a registered nurse, I've worked in a huge variety of roles. I'm actually a military wife, and as a result of marrying and following my husband around for a number of years, that meant I wasn't able to pin down a sort of stable nursing role. So my early experience was very varied across hospital and community and charity settings, which I found really quite nerve-wracking at that time as a young nurse, not a particular extrovert. But actually, I'm really grateful for that because it gave me huge experience to draw on for the roles that I'm in now. And it also forced me to think and work very differently and to make that effort to try new things and do new things in different places. So I'm very grateful. And when we came to settle down, and actually I found the date in a cutting a couple of weeks ago, I actually started in infection control in 1997, which is 29 years ago, which I find incredible. And I started that particular role by accident, working as a bank nurse at that time in Bath, but needing to balance the clinical demands with my home family. So there was a notice in the bank office one day, they needed a bank nurse to do some 9-to-5 work. I was successful in applying for that. That's another story. And loved it. I loved the science. I loved the biology because I've always liked biology, and it allowed me to stay in nursing, importantly, but also to have an interest. And then next time we moved, I was able to pick up an infection control trainee job. And I stayed in it ever since until last year, when I transferred to sustainability. And that was a natural progression because I had already been working on sustainable practices aligned to the prevention of infection for some time. We just hadn't really talked about it in those terms. So it was a natural progression. And now I'm really fortunate and proud, actually, to be the first post holder of this new role at the Royal College of Nursing and a UK-wide role.
I think hearing that story kind of places things really well for me in my mind, because when I've heard you talk, I've always been quite impressed with how you can talk to the acute care as well as the community care in just as much ease. And now I kind of understand a bit more about why that is and where that comes from. So thank you. You talk about it being a natural progression from moving from infection control through to sustainability and where that overlapped. But has there ever been a trigger point, something that really made you go, oh, wow, this is something big. I need to act. I need to be involved.
For me, there's a couple of moments in time that are really vivid. One is work related and one is personal related. And I was part of the huge amount of work that went on in the early 2000s on the back of CJD, when we were involved in supporting the audits of sterile services departments. This was around ensuring that our decontamination facilities were fit for purpose. And on the back of all the CJD work that was going on, and absolutely, you know, being very mindful of risk, because we didn't understand the epidemiology really of it at that time. We were expecting many more cases, and the risk of surgery, of course, was part of that assessment. I remember the move from reusables to single use really vividly, and I actually remember sitting at my desk in the office and asking the question around where were all these single use items going to go after we use them. You know, they were going to landfill or they were being burnt, but I asked the question around how we were going to manage that, and no one could answer that question. So that was one of my very early memories of that. The personal one came about when we went on holiday. We had a big anniversary. We were very fortunate to travel to Madagascar, and which was a huge privilege. And we went to one particular eco place because we were really mindful of travel and the impact of it. And it coincided with humpback whales being present and giving birth. And we were able to witness these extraordinary mammals in their natural environment. It's something I will never forget. And the guides that were with us and the naturalists that were there talked about how precious that environment was, and for the nutrients that were present in the ocean and everything. It's one of those things that will almost always stay with me. And later on that day, after we got off the boat or whatever, we went for a quick snorkel, nothing fancy, 20 metres offshore. And they were very proud of their coral reefs. And I'd never seen a coral reef. And so I snorkeled just off the beach, and was really struck and horrified, because what I actually observed, and they had raised concerns over this, was grey sludge. And it was sludge for as far as you could see, this protected coral reef, except for one piece of pink coral in the middle. And that image has stuck with me forever. And where that took me was that the coral reef was so important for the sort of range of animals, fish, everything that basically kept the humpback whales alive. So it was a complete environment. And the important bit at the bottom of that food chain was dying, and that meant that there would be nothing in a few years left to support these whales that we had witnessed in the afternoon. And I just felt terrible. I felt responsible, I felt guilty, and I felt angry, because I had heard in the media the press talking about climate change, but it was always in the context, and now on to something else. And I felt angry with them for not pursuing and pushing that point further to make me and others do more. So that for me was a personal turning point.
Wow. That Yeah, that sounds very striking moment.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that, Rose. How about you, Helen? Like, everyone has a different take. What would you say? What's nudged you into the sustainability world?
I'm not sure I can follow up from Rose, really, to be honest, but I'll try. I think I partially first sort of realised sustainability was probably important a little bit by accident. So it was probably when we did the gloves off work at Great Ormond Street that it was kind of said in passing. I even remember the head of nursing, he said, you could work the plastic out from that. And we had kind of added it onto the project as a bit of an extra. But pretty soon on, it became evident that that was perhaps to other people the most relevant way that they could see that they were making an impact. There are some parts of infection control, I think, that are quite abstract for people. Like, it's difficult to know what hand hygiene opportunities or moments might contribute to an infection. But people felt, by being given the education, that they were then able to make risk assessments and make decisions that impacted patient care or improved it, but also had a positive effect on things that were important for them. So I honestly do say that I fell into sustainability in the first place. But then that led me, and Nicola reminded me of this before, because I said, I really don't know how to answer this question. It led me to sort of listen and speak to different people that I might not have otherwise come into contact kind of along the way. And I won't get his name right, Nicola. So what's the name of the gentleman from?
Mamu Bitter.
Yeah, thank you. So I had a long conversation with him one day and remember reading some of his papers, and it was about single-use surgical instruments and non-sterile gloves. And I was horrified when I kind of realised how these things are made, really, and sort of the modern slavery that goes into it. So I think for me, it was an acknowledgement that there's absolutely the piece about the environment Rose talks about, but there's also a piece about humanity and this single-use disposable culture, because it's not only saying that, you know, items are single-use and disposable, it's actually through the way that people are treated through us using these products, actually saying that people are disposable and people don't have rights. And I think that probably, I felt quite strongly about that from my time in the military, I think, because actually the ethos of being a military nurse is, you know, you don't have a political view per se. You treat people who come in and you treat everybody equally, be it a soldier from, you know, your army, a soldier from another army, or an enemy soldier, you know, so to speak. So I just felt that there was like a complete inequity in how we treat each other as well as how we treat the environment. So I think that then sort of spurred me on to think, actually, this isn't just about, you know, making our gloves off campaign work or something. It's about, which is important for all the reasons that we've, you know, talked about in different times, it's actually about raising awareness, because many people don't know that, you know, on the streets of India, children are quite commonly maimed because they're involved in, or were certainly involved in the making of those single-use instruments and things. So for me, it wasn't only how they were disposed of, which Rose talked about, but how they were made.
100%. And we should nudge people to go and listen to him talk as well, because it really does strike a chord, especially as a healthcare professional. Just, it goes against your core, doesn't it? It's something I'm so glad the NHS supply chain now really take into account with all our procurement and stuff like that. It feels like it's something that really is being listened to, which is good. Something that we've kind of talked about, like, throughout this series is, you know, we're getting used to hearing about the volumes of plastic, and we're slowly getting used to that conversation around risk to human health, whether it be nanoplastics, microplastics, or the chemicals that are built kind of within those plastics. But we obviously need them. Like, why is it that we need these plastics in healthcare, and where are the benefits to having them? Either of you, what would you say?
I mean, plastics are so useful. You know, I remember even from, you know, being a child and how they supported food storage and all these things. They're, you know, they were really revolutionary when they came in. And it's a bit like other things. I think that, you know, the opportunity to use plastics became apparent very, very quickly. And for health and care services, whether it's a hard plastic or a soft sort of plastic, the different constituents, they can be used for so many things relatively cheaply. And that was a driver. Of course, what we're not very good at doing as people generally, actually, this isn't just in health and care services, is thinking about the unintended consequences of what we do and building that in. So if I go back to the CJD example, we didn't consider the implications of moving over to single use. We didn't address that. We just solved the immediate problem then and there. And here we are, 20 plus years later, trying to reverse that decision with reduced capacity in decontamination services when we're desperately trying to introduce that circular economy. And I think plastics are the same. I went to a conference recently put on by Nature around plastics, and it was utterly fascinating. And I was so struck by how unregulated the plastics industry is, how many types of plastics there are. It is no wonder we cannot recycle things, even if they're not contaminated, you know, in the health and care setting, because everyone creates different polymers and if that's the right word, and they're unregulated and they all have different constituents, and it feels like it's out of control to me. I think there will always be a place for plastics, but we have to rein back on the types of plastics and their use and look for alternatives, and that's where we need the innovation.
I think what I was going to say is, like, what you're saying completely echoes as well to that day-to-day, that unintended consequences is, as a clinician, you go to pick something off the shelf and you have to use what's there in that moment.
In front of you, yeah.
You don't have that time or space, do you, to think about those consequences in the wider picture?
And nor should staff, actually. Absolutely. I mean, I was walking around the wards yesterday and I went into the clinical room, and there was just stuff everywhere. There's no space to draw up drugs because there are boxes of needles and adapters and syringes and consumables everywhere. And the staff were talking, you know, and they are they have no choice but to use what they are given. But they cannot change that. It has to be, you know, those of us that are leading this work, it has to come from organizational leaders, it has to come from the NHS, and it has to come from our politicians, that we are going to do something different.
And we need those people behind the scenes
that
have that ability to think about how it needs to change an SOP, a policy, or procurement,
how you're going to use it,
everything. It's so broad.
I don't disagree with anything either of you have said, but I might argue that, I mean, not it's slightly more complicated than that. I don't mean it in that sense, but I think, you know, if we wear the other hat, if we went back to, if we just take, for example, syringes, you know, if we didn't have plastic syringes, and we think about the decontamination of a syringe and how many times that's used during a day, then, like, actually the infrastructure needed to support that process and the staffing needed to support that process doesn't exist. So at the moment, the way that our healthcare is designed to be delivered, it's actually designed around the use of single use items to reduce staffing primarily.
So how would you see that hospitals would need to change, and what would be the impact if we did go down that route of using more reusables? What would you see that as being, Helen?
You'd have to completely redesign your hospitals as they stand at the moment. you would need decontamination facilities. There's a big drive at the moment to use to move to water light units. I mean, there's always been an understanding that hand wash basins are dedicated for hand wash, but you would need appropriate decontamination facilities in those areas. Potentially, you know, if you think back to the days of the bedpan washer, you might need something in at a local level to sterilise, because I'm not sure that, or disinfect, because I'm not sure that things could function in the same way that they do with a senderway service. And I just don't think that the infrastructure of the wards, departments, GPs is set up to deal with that. I think you'd need the infrastructure to sort of be aspired for and put in place. But I agree with Rose. I think it needs a widespread organisational change in order to prioritise those things. Yeah. So that actually hospitals are probably never going to be carbon neutral in reality, but they could aim towards those things so that where we are able to reuse things, we do.
Yeah. Where we can recycle plastics of a similar nature, actually, our national regulations, our legislation, whatever is in place for very good reasons, that needs to change to help us do the right thing.
I see what you mean there in the idea that there's no point having phone chargers that all have different connections. There should be a mandate across the level that actually, like a phone charger, all now should have the same input into your device. Yeah. We our plastics, if they're a certain type, should be of the same constituents, really.
Yeah.
So that we can recycle
for those
that
purposes.
Level. Yeah. Wow, this is a deep conversation. But Helen, I'm going to follow it by asking you another tricky one, or what I think is tricky. I feel from the outside of infection control that you're always chastised as being the blocker, the challenge. You know, people say, oh, I tried to do that, but then infection control came up and said no. And that's particularly around the point of the number two. Can you tell me a little bit more about what happens when that conversation comes up and we see a number two with a line through it, for instance? What does that mean? Where's it come from? And actually, is the blocker IPC?
Yeah, so the blocker absolutely isn't IPC, as in the individual infection control person. It's not. So the single use symbol, the two with the no entry sign through it, essentially, is an MHRA requirement. So it's that requirement which stipulates it's not any, it's not single use for that patient, it's a single one-time use of that piece of equipment. It really, manufacturers need to really be held, I think, in my opinion, more to account, because actually there's a huge piece around this around manufacturers, and it comes in many different forms, because we've been having conversation with manufacturers about a particular piece of equipment that was being used that has a line with a, you know, single patient, single use, two with the sign through. And they said, I think they said to somebody, well, you could reuse it just for that patient if you wanted to. Well, that's against the MHRA guidance, which is essentially, I suppose, in my basic understanding of it, how the hospital's insured. You know, we agree that's how we will continue to use this, that equipment. And if we use it outside of that specification, if something was to go wrong and harm was to come to a patient, it would very much be our choice, because we had made that decision to move in that way. That being said, I think it's difficult, because I think you encounter the problem of staff really seeing on the ward, I could make a change. There's no reason. I use this one piece of equipment for one thing. It costs X amount of money. It's got this much plastic. I'd like to reuse it. But actually, I think one of the fundamental things that probably should have mentioned alongside the last bit about what we need practically from hospitals and sterilisation is probably something from the MHRA and kind of that kind of leadership about how we move to more reusable equipment, or we create products that are slightly more robust that mean that they can be decontaminated between use and used on the same patient. Without sounding and hopefully putting myself in any trouble, you know, we have to remember that it's in the manufacturer's interest for us to buy more and more of these products. You know, having a single use for the, you know, single use means that we use 50 of them, if for example. If we're not, and actually it's single patient use, we might actually only use 10 of them a month. So it's really about that kind of cost benefit. So I do think something at quite a high level does need to be done, because then it would enable infection control to actually have those conversations, look for more sustainable alternatives. The hands are almost tied if the product that's being asked to be reused has got a single use symbol on it. Because it's an infection.
You're talking about designed obsolescence. It's completely right. And there's something there around MRHA joining work with people like the Greener NHS with their design for life, and really thinking how do we work together. And I hope that they are in that field, because it is designed obsolescence. But I do know, having talked to some manufacturers recently, the bit they struggle with is because they don't have infection control staff or people that understand that clinical nature of how we use it. Sometimes I think they use the two with a cross through as their own safety net, because they can't see that practical implication of how you would go about it.
Yeah. I don't necessarily agree with that. I'm sure Rose will come in. I think there's also something around the single use symbol being associated with the grade of plastic that's being used, is my understanding. So the grade of plastic that's potentially used with the two with a, you know, single use sign through it wouldn't withstand the cleaning required to actually make it single patient use. So it's also about that cost benefit again. I don't believe lots of infection control people I know we can be a bit spiky at times, would be happy to work with manufacturers and actually, you know, not necessarily on every single product, but each infection control team, I don't know what Rose thinks from her days in infection control, probably has particular areas of interest that they're you know, Rose talks about CJD, we think about ventilation and syringes at GOSH, you know, like.
I absolutely agree. And like, I would not accept that manufacturers might allocate something as single use because they can't access expertise. There is plenty of expertise out there. That for me is not a justifiable reason for allocating increased use of resources when there is a better way of doing it. And funny enough, I was having long conversations yesterday about reusable tourniquets versus single use tourniquets. Absolutely fascinating. And the conversations sort of came down to some of the challenges in procurement when you're buying these, and how the single use cost is often displayed next to the cost of the reusable item. So there's instantly a massive discrepancy in costs. And the conversation, and it carried on today, was around, you know, how can we introduce in our procurement catalogues the relative cost per use. So can we break it down? Because that would be a first step in helping to get people to think about it. And actually, if we worked with manufacturers, and if there isn't much difference between an item that can be used 20 times or 30 times, actually, you're going to go with the one that can be used 30 times. That then drives the manufacturers to innovate or think differently about how many times their product might be used. And obviously we want real life scenarios, we don't just want laboratory based scenarios. So that I perhaps there is some work that we can do around, you know, how we do that. It's like buying apples. I was talking about, you know, you can buy them loose per kilo or buy a packet of six and you have no idea how much they weigh. How can you compare the cost of what you're buying in that we can tell what I do on a Saturday morning? So there's stuff that we can do in the procurement catalogues, I think, to help people start to ask, because it is the critical mass that will change this. You know, the pound in your pocket is really, really valuable, really, really valuable. And we shouldn't feel like victims. I don't think.
I like what you're saying there. It rings to a project that I'm doing about infant feeding bottles at the moment, and the single-use plastics that we do, and they are cheap as chips, and we use obviously thousands of these at Great Ormond Street because we've got a lot of babies to feed, but they're cheap as chips in that single moment. But if actually you look at what it would cost over 30 feeds and add in the sterilization process within it, you could save about £13 of over a 30 feed kind of period just moving from a single use bottle to a glass bottle. I mean, you have all the complicated factors that glass has a higher carbon if you only use it once, and you have to work out all of those factors again so you don't get the unintended consequences. But you're right, it shouldn't have taken someone like me in the background to go, I'm going to look at this single use item, I'm going to work this out, our process needs to allow this.
It is really interesting. But you see, the staff that are dealing with this have finite capacity.
100%. Yeah.
And this is where it comes down to actually we need help and support to do this work.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm going to take us to kind of a bigger conversation. But following the COVID-19 pandemic, we saw statistics such as more than 30 billion items of PPE being recalled by the UK government. To me, this illustrates the cycle of the issue that we face. We use these single-use products in healthcare because they have genuine advantages. We need things like PPE, right? And yet they're adding to that waste and to those carbon emissions, which in turn aggravates that risk of future pandemics happening to us. And so we get in this cycle, don't we? And I know that it's not just healthcare system that will be the cause of our increased carbon emissions and hence future pandemics, but we are quite a large contributor to this factor. Rose, do you see us as being, is there a way that we can help break that cycle? Is there stuff that we can do?
I feel that the pandemic in so many ways was a unique opportunity. And, you know, I do need to acknowledge that for many people, it was a very traumatic and difficult time. However, if I put my, as I was then, lead IPC nurse hat on, it was a unique opportunity for learning. And what it did, a bit like the glove work, you know, it was a visual reminder of what happens at scale when we quite rightly used what we had to use to protect healthcare workers. So it's not about not, and never was about not using it. What it did was it highlighted what happens if you get it wrong. If you order the wrong items or they're not fit for purpose, it highlighted how much waste you generate. We almost broke the incinerators with the amount of waste we produced, not just for PPE, but across the board during the pandemic. It highlights your vulnerabilities, education, training. And it importantly for me highlighted how dependent we were on supply chains, which we all knew. But, you know, the whole world wanted to order gloves and FFP3. So, of course, there's going to be shortages. But the role of reusable items, for me, was one of the core aspects. And we've learned so much around the role of air, how organisms, not just SARS-CoV-2, but other organisms can be transferred through the air. We're understanding much more around risks to healthcare workers from chemicals, from drugs, as well as biological hazards like microorganisms. And of course, there will be another pandemic. So we have to learn and we have to look at reusables. So we really, really need to innovate from both a glove perspective, but also from a respiratory protective equipment perspective. I don't know, Helen's got a particular view on aprons and things like that. How we create and use these items that are fit for purpose but are also comfortable to wear, because the impact on staff was horrendous. And we're only going to see more extreme heat episodes as time moves on. So this is going to become more and more important for daily practice, not just a once in a couple of generations sort of type things. And then many staff, of course, were struck by seeing PPE being littered around, whether it was in a bird's nest, it was chucked on the floor, floating on the beach, wherever it was. So I think that that experience, I hope, will galvanize action and responsibilities. And I also hope that the UK COVID-19 inquiry will listen to the concerns of nurses around how we need to build sustainability into this work and the learning that they will identify and recommendations for us.
Yeah, God, that is something that we could spend hours unpicking more of. I've asked one question among many, and we could probably talk about it all day. And I find it really fascinating, anything from when you say about the comfort, thinking about all those nurses that we did fit testing for in the hospital to make sure that their PPE properly fit them. And actually, there were so many staff devastated that they couldn't use certain PPE because then often just not designed for, say, like a female.
They're designed for a male face of a certain size, not. And of course, we have so many nurses from different ethnic backgrounds. Yeah. You know, we have different face shapes, we have different hairstyles, we have different body shapes. And we learned from Ebola that one size fits all PPE just did not work. That was the key point of learning from the Ebola incident in Madrid, when unfortunately a healthcare worker died. So, you know, we've really got to take this opportunity to learn with both hands, you know, because next time it could be worse, much, much worse. Yeah.
Do you think as well, Rose, that there's something about, I acknowledge the role of PPE, absolutely, and don't, you know, derogate from the fact we need it, but there are other systems that need to be put in place, because we know the PPE on the hierarchy of controls, which we look at in infection control, is the least reliable. We should be doing all the other things. For me, actually, what COVID-19 highlighted as an infection control lead was all the other sort of infrastructure things that need to be in place in healthcare. Not to say that we don't need PPE and we shouldn't use it, but, you know, we need to know what the ventilation looks like. We there's so many things. And I just, it felt very much that like a key learning point from that moving forward isn't to say that absolutely, of course, we need PPE for a novel infection. And of course, we need to protect our staff and that needs to be there. But there are a whole heap of other things that should already be in place, meaning that that is an additional support rather than the only support that
definitely staff have got. Definitely. And that can only have a positive effect on the number of items that we use. I mean, it is all about learning. You know, we trusted the health technical memorandum, the building notes, as being sufficient and adequate. And what the pandemic taught us was that actually they're not sufficient. So that learning, the need to build in, be it air filtration units or better ventilation. And actually, it's about comfort for the staff as much as it is about the prevention of infection. These wards are so stuffy, they're so hot, there's very little daylight. You know, if you're going through the menopause or you're on other medication, you know, that makes you heat intolerant, then actually it's really, really difficult to work and concentrate and make decisions. So all this learning, and of course the hierarchy of controls, in my opinion anyway, is poorly understood, because it's not a linear process. You don't move from one step to the other. You know, you don't move on to the next one until you've completed the other one. You can have more than one control in place at any one time, and that's a point that's poorly misunderstood, and that led to people not understanding, and the removal of PPE in some cases. So it all has to work. The system has to work, which is why we, you know, need that learning to help us and to help the decision makers actually put in place what we need to be able to work in those circumstances.
One of the key bits of learning that I hope comes out is that adaptation piece. Like you say, supply chains, what happens when you can't get hold of things? Because actually I feel since the pandemic, in my role when I was a lead practice educator, it was almost weekly that we were getting sort of information saying we can't get hold of this line, we can't get hold of this, can you help train the nurses to use a different product, because we can't get hold of things in the same way and we haven't got that stable world that we can rely on our supply chain. So reusables do come into this as a reasonable alternative in many cases.
And potentially UK manufacturing, but then sometimes we still have to import the raw materials. It's like gloves. We would still have to import the raw materials to the UK if we were to manufacture, you know, medical gloves or surgical gloves here. So it solves one problem, but it doesn't solve the whole problem. And that's why appropriate consumable use is so important, because it's a key part of resilience.
And I guess that links me to quiz you a little bit, Helen, about your latest project about virology sampling, because what I like there is you're not just necessarily looking at, can I change one product for another? You've been looking at a whole process. Can you tell us a little bit more about it?
I think it's slightly, probably slightly unique to Great Ormond Street, because obviously we do a lot of virology testing because children get a lot of viruses. But what we were really, I suppose what we were really interested in from an infection control point of view is that we would see patients have repeat, they would test positive for RSV, and then we would see repeat tests every 3 days until they were negative. So, you know, that might be like 10 or 12 tests, sometimes longer. And I suppose what we wanted to do was understand a few things. We wanted to understand the environmental impact, because obviously there's the things that the nurses are using on the wards to take, for example, the nasopharyngeal aspirate. But then there's also this whole piece of work in the laboratory about how the testing takes place and all the plastics associated with that. So we looked into it. And basically, I suppose we created pieces of guidance. We'd had guidance before, but it'd been very much perhaps ad hoc. We had been about to sort of release guidance about retesting after patients had tested positive for viral respiratory pathogens or viruses, but had been sort of waylaid by COVID for a good number of years. but we saw it as an opportunity to kind of really provide nursing staff primarily with more of a structure around testing, around when patients were no longer infectious and could come out, so a way to reduce healthcare associated infections, but also a way to reduce unnecessary testing for patients, because actually, that in itself is a huge burden, not only on the laboratories, but actually on the patients themselves being tested when they don't need to be. So we've kind of really focused on those things. And we've started across respiratory viral samples. We've also standardized across stool samples to repeat testing, ideally not being more than once a week for any of those. So once a patient's tested positive, we wouldn't be looking to retest them for at least 7 days. And then if they're positive, don't retest them for 7 days. Unless we've tried to be reasonable, obviously, and sort of remember, you know, we've got patients who are sick in hospital. So if they have new onset symptoms, you know, of course it's sensible to send a new sample to test to see if they've acquired something else. I think one of the problems that we had run across previously is that children get so many respiratory viral infections in a year that actually it can be really difficult with some of our children, particularly at GOSH, that here a long time. By the time they've got over one infection, they've already potentially got it again, especially if it's a common one like rhinovirus. So we've begun with that. It's been a great experience. I suppose a bit similar to gloves off in a way, but working with the virology staff on a daily basis, working with the lab staff. So just working more closely with them as an infection control team so that they can come and ask us if a sample comes in, this sample's come in, we don't know why it doesn't meet the criteria for testing. So for example, our rapid testing should only be done in the intensive cares primarily. So if it comes in from the ward, they'll come and bring the sample number to us. We'll call the ward, have a chat with the team about why it's being sent, about, and then discuss which test would be the most appropriate actually for that patient. So it's working quite well. And we probably picked a terrible time to launch because we picked November and then we saw flu season in December. But it is having an impact. And these things take time, as we know from Gloves Off. So actually, it is about just keeping going and keeping going with the change. But I think, it's working quite well.
And I love the fact that you're looking at that triple bottom line. You're looking at every aspect from the time of the staff, the impact on the patients, the finance, the sustainability. It all runs into one. I think that, you might say virology in that sense is quite specific to Great Ormond Street, but I like the way it's taking a sort of almost patient pathway, or looking from the lab's perspective even. So not the way we typically would look at some of these healthcare sustainability projects.
We've already moved into microbiology stool testing, so we couldn't just stop at one. So, and that is far more complex than the virology, but already, 12 samples cancelled on Monday, 5 samples cancelled on Tuesday, 4, 3 samples cancelled, significant. Yeah. Numbers, because actually just that bit of investment and that bit of understanding why people are sending things and giving them the education. I think it highlights that actually we know how important healthcare scientists are in the laboratory in helping diagnose and manage our patients. Actually, we need to give them the information so that they can run the right test.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for sharing that. I think you'll probably inspire quite a few people to have a look from a similar kind of perspective and angle. Rose, like many hospitals, Great Ormond Street, we're looking at that. How do we do prompt switches from IV to oral medications? Because in my head, it has a benefit of reducing plastics from the Born Green perspective, but also reduces our carbon emissions from things like syringes, needles, cannulas, all of the excess that goes with IV administration. When you hear about projects like this, do you consider any other climate or sustainability issues that have an interplay beyond, say, plastics and carbon? What else do you think of?
And I think that antimicrobial resistance, and for nursing, antimicrobial stewardship is a really nice example of actually how in many ways nurses are already practicing sustainable practices, or are implementing quality improvement projects that have sustainable benefits. My colleague in the US, a lady called Rita Olens, wrote a lovely paper on antimicrobial stewardship, and she said that good nursing is good antimicrobial stewardship. And I'm currently writing something at the moment around good nursing is sustainable nursing. And this is actually about doing what we know we should be doing already and making sure we do that. So that starts, as Helen was saying, around by taking the right specimen, processing, acting on the result. Really, really important. How many results aren't acted on, either positive or negative? Then making sure that the patient has the right medication via the right route for the right amount of time, and that can be IV to oral. And then, following on from that, the patient pathway in that perspective. So I think stewardship is absolutely at the centre of sustainable nursing practice. Nurses so often think that perhaps they have to do a project on X to be doing something on sustainability. Actually, we don't. We already have the learning from the productive ward. We already have antimicrobial stewardship practices. We already know, that it's better to take a patient to the bathroom than it is to keep them in a bed and use continence products. So there's so much we can do. I think it's just about helping them join up the dots. And seeing themselves in the context of that practice, that's important. But it's a really good example, IV to oral.
And are there any other projects out there that you see other in other hospitals that you would like to see more of us take on?
Well, there's a whole load of work, really good work going on. But what I'm hearing when I talk to nurses trying to implement these, whether they have an idea or whether they're halfway through a project, it is that they're hitting so many barriers. They're hitting so many brick walls. It's not that people aren't bought in. It's just that others around them that have the ability to make a project fly or stop it in its tracks for multiple reasons actually put obstacles in the place. Some of these are very real, but some of these are perhaps misunderstandings or people fear the consequences of doing it, so that they don't have the knowledge and the education. So there is lots of work going on across adult social care, the independent sector and the NHS in all areas of nursing practice. Not all are around consumables. So there's some fantastic work going on in residential homes around removing caffeinated drinks from residents as an example. What impact does that have? Well, it means that patients sleep better. It means that they are not so disturbed. So they are having less falls. That means that less people are being transferred to the acute trust, and therefore the demand on the acute trust is reduced. Their mood is better. Their appetite is better. So they're healthier. So they're more resilient as residents. That is sustainable nursing practice. That is just one example. It doesn't involve consumables directly, but it will have an impact on the consumables that we use. You know, community equipment loan stores, making sure that people have the right equipment when they're discharged so they don't bounce back into hospital, or that, you know, they're set up to be independent is another example, along with all sorts of things around procurement decision tools, recycling of insulin pens, you name it. There's fantastic work going on, but some of the really big stuff, particularly around things like getting rid of single use curtains, and I can see Helen's face now on that. I was talking to a trust yesterday about that, and there's all sorts of blockers in place. Somebody needs to make a decision to say this will happen. So nurses are increasingly saying, in addition to coming up with ideas for where we can make changes, actually we need our senior leadership team, we need our trust board, we need our senior NHS leaders to make it a must do. That then means that we can do what we need to do in practice.
Is there anything that you think will nudge that must do from the leader's perspective?
So I've been thinking a lot about this, and because of my history with infection prevention and control, in my head, and this isn't necessarily the right answer, but I think it's a good place to start a conversation, because there's nothing like sort of getting people animated to come up with ideas. And I remember on the back of the huge outbreaks of Clostridium difficile in the mid 2000s, the impact of the introduction of the code of practice for healthcare associated infection that had. It generated, don't get me wrong, a huge amount of work for those working in trusts and other care settings to map themselves against the requirements of the code and provide evidence that they were doing this. I feel, given that we're in a climate crisis, that this is so important. You know, this is the biggest threat to human and planetary health that we have ever faced. This is important enough for us to create a code of practice or something similar that can be used by regulators to hold trusts and other healthcare providers to account, that stimulates action and clarifies roles and responsibilities, which at the moment can be quite hard to identify. That's my personal throw it in and see what happens idea.
Well, I for one would agree with you. It would be I think, really useful in our field to have something beyond having a board member that is responsible for it and a green plan, but actually having that
and just goodwill. You know, we're not going to change this on goodwill, or we'd have done it already.
And we're not going to change it at the pace that we need to.
Yeah, 100%. Absolutely.
Yeah. Helen, take us to the steps to the future for a hospital, for instance. How do you think we might need to change them? We've touched on this a little bit briefly at the beginning, but how do you think, you know, we design buildings and they don't get built for sort of almost 10 years from the point of we need a building. It takes so long in that whole design stage, let alone construction stage. What would you see change within the way we use hospitals?
I think it's probably complex, and we touched on it already. I don't really think hospitals have got the infrastructure to do what we need them to do. But that's not to say it can't be overcome. I kind of think almost each, there are parts of what we can't get to immediately, for example, but there are things we can do. If we just take the horrible disposable curtains, which anybody who knows me knows is my hatred, nobody likes them anyway, because they're impossible to use aside from anything else, aside from the fact they're nearly £100 a piece and they have to go in waste and they're made of plastic. I mean, they are everything about them is not to like. And as someone who was a patient, how they provide you with any dignity or privacy, I don't know, because they're paper thin, because they're basically paper impregnated with plastic. But we've certainly made a big drive to think about either using curtains that go through the laundry, or actually when it comes to, you know, refurbishing or things, actually using screens that do function properly. It's important to find the right one, so you don't just want to get one that's going to fall down every time you use it. But there are screens out there that will go around patient bed spaces. Yes, there is obviously an impact of the cost of buying it. You know, they are still made of plastic, but they're able to be cleaned every day, which curtains can't be. The ongoing things are, you know, helpful for them. So I suppose, I think there's almost two strands. I suppose there's the strand about what can we change that we've got at the moment that could make an impact on things, and how can we think about that? And I suppose listen to the people on the wards, because most of, I can't remember where I spoke, but one of the things we spoke about was actually the changes that work the best are normally those that make the most sense to people.
Yeah.
So if you make a change and people think, oh, actually, that makes sense, I've always thought that was a stupid idea, that's just what I was always told to do, then actually that change will work much better. So I do think it's about listening to staff, understanding how their life can be made easier, because actually perhaps also, you know, if we look at patient flow, one of the biggest reasons you wait for a patient bed is while someone puts curtains up. I think curtains are just beyond it, in general.
It just doesn't make sense, does it?
I don't understand why we have them. So there are so many things. I mean, that's just one example. I do think to move to where we need to get to with sustainability, there probably does need to be input into things like the health technical memorandums. They need to be done jointly. I suppose we talk about silos in healthcare, don't we? And I think very much that understanding of the different ways things are used are very siloed, and it probably needs to be more of a multidisciplinary team approach in those things to actually understand what can we do now, what can we do in 5 years, and what can we do in 10 years, and work towards all of them concurrently.
Thank you so much. I feel like I've thrown some pretty tricky questions at you guys, but you always answer in a way that I'm not necessarily expecting. So I'm learning things constantly from chatting to you. Thank you both so much for joining me today. I really, really appreciate your input. And I'm sure that you will have inspired many listeners to at least bring their chair to the table and be part of this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Gosh Pods Goes Green. We would love to get your feedback on the podcast and any ideas you may have for future episodes. You can find a link to the feedback page in the episode description, or email us at digital.learning@gosh.nhs.uk. If you want to find out more about the work of the Gosh Learning Academy, you can find us on social media, on Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You can also visit our website at www.gosh.nhs.uk and search Learning Academy. We have lots of exciting new podcasts coming soon, so make sure you're subscribed wherever you get your podcasts. We hope you enjoy this episode, and we'll see you next time. Goodbye.